Major House, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Leeds.
Which year was that?
1911.
What did your father do for a living?
My father had two shops, outfitters.
And did you have your schooling in Leeds?
Yes, I went to a central high school in Leeds, which was a very large institution, like most cities, like Liverpool, Manchester had one large institution, which was an academic factory, really.
When did you finish your schooling? Well, with your education?
I finished at the age of 17. I'd already taken my advanced level. And my father asked me if I wanted to go to university. I'd seen one of the shops already go, and my sister was at college. And I said, no, I wanted to go out to work. He didn't believe me, but he just accepted the fact.
What did you go into?
I went into accountancy in the city treasurer's office as a clerk.
What were you doing when war broke out?
Oh, I'd already gone into teaching. After 3 years, my father asked me again if I wanted to go to university, and I'd become interested in young people through the Scouts. And so I said, well, no, I'll go to a training college and get on with teaching as quickly as possible. So I went to a training college and took a teaching certificate. And then I got a job in Leeds.
Had you been in the TA before the war?
No. No. When the war came along, I was already 28 and in a reserved occupation. So I had to wait until 1940 before I went into the forces. I I'd already decided that we would close our house for the war, and my wife decided to go back to teaching during the war. So I had a great friend who was the director of education for Warrington. We played rugby together, and so he gave her a job. And I went into the South Lancashire Regiment because their depot was in Warrington.
What would have been your reaction when you heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
Certainly not surprised. I mean, it had hung over us for 2 or 3 years. Everybody knew that eventually something would happen.
Were you dismayed?
No, I don't think so. Not particularly. In 1940, we had billeted some of the people who came back from Dunkirk. And that really was the worst time, because one felt really that the British forces were not coping at all, and there was a certain mood of depression about them.
Did you speak very much about the military situation with those men from Dunkirk?
Yes, but they took it very lightly, of course. You know, they like soldiers do, they took it all in good form. They were more concerned with how many cigarettes they'd brought back, and
were you in any of the early bombing by the German Air Force of Britain?
No, I think one or two bombs had dropped in the outskirts of Leeds. But it was not until I was in the forces that German bombing became an important factor. When I was in training in Warrington, this would be perhaps October 1940, the German Air Force firebombed Liverpool and Manchester. And Warrington is exactly midway between, and we could see from when we looked towards Manchester, the flames in the sky, and when we looked towards Liverpool. And obviously, most of the intake, which I had gone in with, were conscripts from Liverpool and Manchester. And the following morning, the CEO of the depot paraded everybody and said, fall out the people from Manchester here and the people from Liverpool there. I will give you 36 hours leave to go home to see what's happened. And if you have any difficulty, go to the police, but do let us know. And every one of them came back on time.
Were they much disturbed when they came back?
One or two of them were, yes. And the fellow who had a bed next but one to me, he had lost his house. His wife and his child were safe, but he had a very personal attitude to the war after that. I met him just before we took Bremen in 1945. Well, he was with us actually when we landed, although we'd served in separate areas in between. And he had taken his own personal retribution. He had all sorts of things collected, which he'd collected from various sources. The war was very personal to him, very, very personal.
Things that he'd taken from houses.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted his own back.
He wanted his own back.
What was your own personal attitude towards the enemy in the war?
Well, of course, as soon as casualties started mounting, and particularly the anti-personnel mines which we met, one felt very deeply about what appeared to be unfair practices. You see, anti-personnel mines can kill anybody, civilians, babies, children, and so on. And one felt very deeply about it. I remember one occasion when one of our officers lost a foot, and the fellow officer went straight in to try and get him out, and he lost a foot. And at that particular time, a sergeant was bringing back some German prisoners, and without hesitation, they were driven onto the minefield. And fortunately, none of them were hurt, but they were made to carry out the casualties. This, I think, was fairly common practice.
Was that in Normandy?
No, actually in Holland.
Now, we've jumped ahead a bit, so if we can go back to your having been at Warrington, can you tell me what happened to you there and how things developed for you, please?
Well, after my basic training, I was selected straight away and went to Op2 in Wales. I think it was either 164 or 165 Op2. And enjoyed that tremendously. This was in the spring and summer of 45. Sorry, wrong. The spring and summer of 41, that would be. Spring and summer of 41.
How did you personally take to soldiering?
Oh, I enjoyed it in many ways. I enjoyed the precision. I'd always been a a great walker in the hills. I enjoyed the physical side tremendously, the training. The physical activity.
Were you treated fairly in the initial training by those in charge?
Oh, yes, of course, yes. The sergeants one did the usual thing, you know, and tried to jolly you along, but they were good-hearted, yes. The initial training was very, very good.
Did you, in the early days, go on to coastal defence?
No, my first job as an officer, actually, was with a home defence unit, the 30th Battalion. They had 30th battalions in those days, and our job was, of course, to defend strategic units. We defended the ICI works at Runcorn, and we defended various other areas like that. And then these battalions were broken up, and I went then to Orkney, which was horrible, really. Orkney in the winter is not very, very pleasant. And I was very glad to get away from Orkney. First of all, I was seconded to the Combined Operations Headquarters at Inverary, where I was expected to train people how to get into landing craft and how to get out of landing craft. The whole thing seemed to me pretty useless, actually. They would take a whole battalion at a time and do certain prescribed exercises. There was no reality about them. There was no actual fire. They weren't going to, you know, they were supposed to land on opposed beaches, but on defended beaches, but there were no reality about it at all. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, I went to the commanding officer and said, "I'm not very good at this," and he agreed with me, and so I was sent away then. I went back to Orkney, and immediately the grapevine told of a draft going down to the 1st Battalion, who were then stationed in Folkestone and in that area doing coastal defence. And I paraded before the commanding officer and volunteered to go with the draft, much to his disgust. And so I was put in charge of this particular draft of people who were going to make up the strength of the 1st Battalion. They had actually been, they were in the 3rd Division, which had been agreed to do the landing in Sicily. And then we understood that we were not going to do it, and the Canadians did it instead. I think it was a political decision. So the divisional general, who was called Ramsden, if I remember rightly, got a promise from the War Office that the 3rd Division would be used in the invasion of Normandy, or in the invasion of the continent, as was all that we knew of then at that particular time. And so we went to Scotland, first of all to Dumfries, and then to the northeast, near Inverness. We had almost a whole year in Scotland training, and much of our training was in company units, where we'd good old mountaineering and hardening training, good deal of marching about. And then later, of course, we were joined up with our naval force, S force, and we did a large number of minor and major exercises of landing on the East Coast in the Merry Firth area. And in, what was that now? Where else did we go?
Herschel?
No, it's mainly on the East Coast that we did our landings. Mainly on the East Coast.
Did you feel that this training prepared you adequately for what was to come?
Yes, I think we were very well trained, yes. We had divisional battle schools. All our men went to battle schools and were taught how to attack, how to assault strong points, concrete fortifications, how to cross minefields, all the initial work of an assault we were taught very well. And it showed it when the actual event came along. No scrambling mats or anything, we were the elite. We got into our boats and were lowered at the lowering position and so on. And the North Sea in winter and spring is pretty cold, of course, and pretty rough sometimes, so that we had plenty of opportunity to get used to an assault landing.
Were there any accidents in the training?
Oh, yes. Yes. One didn't hear much about them, but one had accidents with artillery fire. Demonstrations of advancing under a creeping barrage, where one or two shells fell short, and one or two accidents at sea, of course, as we were lowered. The Navy had to learn how to lower the assault craft. I remember one occasion, actually, where it was one of the early ones, where the the lowering went wrong, and one assault craft was left still coupled at the bow, so that the rear end was in the water, and then it went down again, and eventually, apparently, they used to have an engineer on the engine taking out his orders from the lieutenant, and he suddenly appeared out of this like a soap out of your hand and dived overboard rather than stay on board and be thrashed about, and we thought it was great fun.
What was the attitude in your battalion towards going into Europe? Was morale high? Were people raring to go, or reluctant, or what?
Oh, I think morale was pretty high. The battalion had been sorted out. For example, I became adjutant about 4 weeks before D-Day. Because the CO only joined us about 5 weeks before D-Day. There was constantly a sorting out of officers, of NCOs and men. And by the time D-Day came along, the battalion had really been sorted out. You've got rid of all the people who you didn't feel could cope. And I was made adjutant very much against my own wishes, actually.
Why did you not wish it?
Well, I'd always tried to avoid being a teacher. And right from the beginning, I decided I would never do a desk job. And I wanted to just be a soldier. But the CO said, you have no choice in this matter, you are adjutant.
Once you got the job, did you find that it suited you or not?
I grew into it, yes, I grew into it. One or two, in the early stages, the commanding officer was Richard Burberry. He's mentioned in John Masters' Bugles and the Tiger, John Masters' autobiography. He's mentioned as the adjutant of the 1st or 2nd DCLI to which John Masters was attached before he went to the Gurkhas. And he mentions him as a fierce disciplinarian. He was a very fine soldier, and he set out immediately to train me as he had been trained in India. And, for example, the first time I delivered the battalion to a staff line, in the inquest afterwards, he criticized me for being 45 seconds too soon.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I realized what he was doing, I think, you know. And another time, I'd spent a lot of nights getting the maps ready for everybody, packets of maps, parcels of maps, right down to section corporals, and got very little sleep. And he suddenly put the battalion on 1 hour's notice, and then he suddenly started a night attack without warning, and he criticized me for wearing pajamas underneath my battle dress. He was a great chap. He was a wonderful soldier. Unfortunately, he would have been. We would have lost him, of course. He would have been a brigadier or even divisional commander eventually, but he was killed on the beaches.
And his name was Burberry?
Burberry. Richard Burberry.
Was he connected with a famous family?
I don't know, but when on holiday in Norfolk many years afterwards, I saw a plaque in a church in memory of him. So he must have come from that part of the world.
When you said that the officers were weeded out as unsuitable, what kind of things made them unsuitable?
How physical performance, for one thing. Their way of life, another thing. We had one or two officers who drank too much, spent weekends whenever they could in the neighboring towns, and it was questionable really if they faced it. The commanding officer decided on exercises whether you were performing as you should. For instance, we had one chap who was a solicitor, or he'd been trained at a university in law, and his job on a particular night exercise was to deliver a fatigue party carrying rolls of Dunnet wire, so that this particular hill top could be defended. They would wire around it. And he was given a map reference as to where he had to get his party. And the time he had to arrive. And they set off. And the company sergeant major in the rear had some difficulty keeping the men up. Particularly as one of them said, "We passed that gate 3 times already." And the CSM managed to keep them in line by using a pickaxe handle. But unfortunately for this young man, when the exercise ended and everything, dawn came, the divisional commander was there when they arrived, very much bedraggled. And he was obviously a very good law student, obviously unsuitable for a fatigue party carrying Dunnet wire. And away he went. He was, he disappeared in within the day. Didn't last a single day.
Was the CSM supposed to have beaten the men with a piece of stick?
Well, you know, CSMs were a law unto themselves, weren't they? They had their own ways of keeping order. No, this was all, this general sorting out, I think, was very good. Applied even to men. Some of the men we sent away who were not particularly suitable for field work. And it really improved morale because everybody knew that they were an elite battalion.
Do you think they were an elite battalion?
I think so, yes. When they first landed. Didn't last all that long because of casualties, but they were an elite battalion when they landed.
Do you think that was because of Burberry?
Yes. Yes.
Now, let's take the preparations a bit further, please, with your being in Scotland. Any other memories from those combined ops days in Scotland?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Can we take it the next stage then? Presumably you then went to the south of England.
Yes, we went down to Cowplain, Waterlooville, just outside Portsmouth, where we went into one of the camps, the marshalling areas. And I believe we had, if I remember right, we had an exercise or two there. And everybody had a 24-hour leave, a short leave. We had all the usual inspections. The King George the VI inspected us. Eisenhower inspected us. And Montgomery, of course, inspected us. The usual spit and polish before an inspection, but one was struck by the way the King looked everybody in the eye as he moved up and down the whole battalion. And everybody thought, you know, what a terrible strain it must be to go on for a whole day inspecting, looking everybody full in the face, in the eye. It was very impressive, actually, some of those parades. And then, of course, the camps were closed eventually. They were sealed.